This interview with Professor Don Burnett, the principal investigator and lead scientist of NASA's Genesis mission, is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, visit jodcast.net.
Okay, the Sun had a disk like this. That's what we refer to as a solar nebula, which is a disk of gas and dust particles intermixed together. And as the Sun formed, some of the material in this disk that was left behind towards the final stages actually ended up forming all the planetary objects that we have today. And the most remarkable thing that we found about studying the solar system in the last 20 or 30 years is that the various bodies in the solar system, the planets, the moons, the asteroids, they're all different. Every one of them appears to be different. And so we've ended up with a solar system of a lot of diverse materials and objects out of a solar nebula that is generally believed to have been fairly uniform in terms of what it's made of. And in other words, when I say what it's made of, I mean the relative amounts of one element to another, to iron, to magnesium, to oxygen, to something like that. And then looking in a little more detail, at the relative amounts of different isotopes of different elements. The nitrogen that all of us are breathing in this mixture minute is a mixture of two different kinds of nitrogen atoms. One's heavier than the other, which we refer to as nitrogen 15, as opposed to the lighter one being nitrogen 14. And the proportion of nitrogen 15 to nitrogen 14 in various solar system materials is different. It's from direct observation. The Earth's atmosphere has one value, which we take sort of as a reference, and we sort of think of anything else relative to that. But many meteoritic materials have a lot more nitrogen 15 in relative to nitrogen 14 than what we have in the Earth's atmosphere.
So we'd presume that from a solar nebula, which we presume to be made of exactly the same sort of stuff, and the solar system and the Sun included, was created from the same nebula, the same composition. Everything should therefore have pretty much the same composition.
Should have started out the same. Started out the same. But today it's ended up being different. And the story for the elements and the isotopes may be fairly different. There are lots of ways to fractionate elements. All of geochemistry is involved in that. So if I make a terrestrial rock-like planet, it's made out of silicon and oxygen primarily. And in the process of making a planet that's a rock, I tend to leave behind hydrogen and helium. So, you know, there's big changes in the chemical composition there.
The lighter elements tend not to be used.
Its volatility is the main criteria, but the more abundant lighter elements, more abundant volatile elements are also the lighter ones. Now, the situation with isotopes is very different. The processes by which you change the ratio of nitrogen 15 and nitrogen 14 are much more limited. And because it's much more limited, they may be more specific about why the change occurred, where you don't have, you know, you have 150 different ways to change the ratio of hydrogen to oxygen, but you maybe only have two or three different ways to change the ratio of nitrogen 15 to nitrogen 14. So it should be much more diagnostic of what's happened.
It's more sensitive to specific physical environments.
On the other hand, the first order assumption is nothing happened to the isotopes. But nitrogen, in terms of what's known in solar system materials, tells us that that's not true. And the same is true for oxygen, by the way. So there are these differences, which are basically not known as how they occurred. And the idea is, in the standard model, that both the elemental and the isotopic composition of the solar nebula is preserved for us today in the surface layers of the Sun. The solar wind is the expansion of the surface layers of the Sun out into space, continually flowing out. And to get a sample of solar matter, therefore, all you have to do is put materials in the way of solar wind, capture the atoms and bring them back, and then try to recover the solar composition, or solar wind composition, from your captured materials.
And that's the...
That's what Genesis did.
That's the basis of Genesis, isn't it? You want to try, well, you make the assumption that the composition of the solar nebula exists as we see on the surface of the Sun. It's being blown off as the solar wind. Let's go get some.
Exactly.
So that's basically the Genesis mission.
Now, we have to face the possibility that in extracting the solar wind from the sun, it changes composition. And that has happened to some degree, and that's an issue which we have to deal with. We're in the middle of dealing with that right now.
Is that the issue that the solar wind, when it interacts with the collecting medium, actually changes, or something else?
No, it's that's pretty minor. We know that's well controlled. It's when the sun, it's in going from the sun to the solar wind, it's not exactly composition independent. Things happen to it. It changes. And to a lesser extent, things happen to the isotopes also. They are also, as we say, fractionated.
Can you describe that in a little bit more detail?
Yes. I mean, basically, let me talk about the solar physics. And I'm not a solar physicist, so this is my view of it, but I think I have it qualitatively correct. The outer surface layers of the sun are this churning mass of gas that you see in any of the spectacular images that are available of the solar surface. And this produces a fairly well-mixed so-called outer convection zone for the sun. But most of the material there is in the form of atoms, not the form of ions. They have the atoms have the right number of electrons, so they're overall neutral. But as the material is ejected from the sun in stages from this convection zone into the solar corona, the bright outer envelope of the sun that's seen in the picture of the sun at a solar eclipse by the moon, the material is heated quite strongly, and then the material from the solar corona is gravitationally unbound and escapes as the solar wind. So then as the material is heated and put up in the corona, then the first stage, it becomes ionized. So it goes from a neutral atom to an ion by losing electrons. And elements that are difficult to ionize, helium being the best example of that, tend not to be as effectively extracted from the convection zone of the sun up into the corona. And so then you get the elements left behind, or fractionated, which are hard to ionize. And so iron, which is very easy to ionize, gets extracted very efficiently, where helium is difficult to ionize, gets left behind. And so the iron to helium ratio in the solar corona is now different. Then these ionized elements are then further heated and accelerated out of the solar corona, and that becomes a solar wind. And this is acceleration process of the ions that then produces, according to this Coulomb drag theory, produces differences depending on the mass. And so in this case, the helium-3 isotope will be extracted more differently than the helium-4 isotope. And so you will get fractionation.
This is due to the differences in mass of the isotopes.
That's right. It involves both charge and mass and speed. And so the equations are fairly complicated, but they do depend on mass. And so, indeed, in our experiments, we see differences in the helium-3, helium-4 ratio from the solar wind the high-speed solar wind that we collected separately from the low-speed solar wind. We see a well-defined 6% difference there that really has to be described as something like the Coulomb drag. And in fact, the amount of fractionation and the direction of fractionation is in accord with the Coulomb drag theory.
So Genesis was designed to go out, collect bits of the solar wind, and then return. It's an exciting part of the mission. It was not just to go out there and analyze, it was go out and bring back.
We added the extra step, which is somewhat harder, but it was not in any way prohibitive from either the technical point of view or the cost point of view in our case, is to bring the material back to Earth to analyze. Once you have done that, then all kinds of wonderful things open up for you. Your ability to analyze, to do the analysis, is not limited by any of the restrictions you have on a spacecraft in terms of mass and power and this type of thing.
Of course, putting packages onto a space probe is expensive in that you've got to launch it there and power it, and they've all got to be incredibly robust. Yet if you can bring the sample back to Earth, you've got labs across the planet that will be pleased.
Since every one of our instruments weighs more than our spacecraft did. mass spectrometers have big magnets on them, which tend to weigh a lot. We are using some instruments that are as big as the NASA centers themselves. Mm. That instruments are basically storage rings that generate X-rays that that are kilometers in size.
Yes.
So
you can't put one of those in.
No. See, so not only we have all these possibilities today, as something new is developed, we're ready to use it. We match the material to the new technique.
It's an interesting point too, because these missions that you design and then build, test, and then launch, they take decades from conception through to building, through to launch, and then analysis.
By the time you've launched it, you could have built something much, much better, but you can't because it's already built and you're ready to go. And so you're schedule limited too. You can't change anything. It's just, it is a big risk to do a lot of changes.
Describe how the Genesis probe collected bits of the solar wind.
Okay, the basic requirement is simple. We had to get far enough away from the Earth to escape the perturbations of the solar wind by the Earth's magnetic field. But there is a place called the L1 point, which is the point in space where the gravitational forces of the Earth and Sun are balanced. And since the Sun weighs much more, this place on this fulcrum is very close to the Earth. It's about 1 million kilometers away from the Earth. And it's a very stable point to put a spacecraft in because it's very easy to get to. It's very cheap power-wise to get there. And so it is the favorite spot for any mission that studies the Sun in any way or the other. And so we parked our spacecraft out there beside all the other ones that are out there. There are 3 or 4 of them out there as we speak, studying various aspects of the Sun and the solar wind. And then when we got done, we pulled away and waved goodbye to our friends there and then came home. And so all we did was out there. Once we got out there, we settled down. We opened the cover of what we call the canister, and then we deployed these various materials. We exposed them straight to the solar wind.
So particles of the solar wind would basically get trapped by this.
That's right. We know a fair amount about the solar wind. We know it is a plasma. It has a certain velocity that when ions of this velocity hit material, they basically almost always stick. And the cases where that might not be true, we sort of understood in advance. And so we were quite sure that if we stuck our materials in front of the solar wind, we would collect it. And since they're atoms, they are not you cannot be destroyed by the stopping.
So you have, one set of collection material plates, or were there different experiments?
We had a variety of different experiments. The bulk of what we studied so far came on big, what we call collector arrays. These were about 1 meter in diameter, in which each array had a set of hexagonally shaped collectors of different materials, and the different materials are selected for different experiments. We optimized the material to what we wanted to analyze. And then these were exposed to the solar wind, and then there was a special set of them which was exposed to different kinds of solar wind. In fact, there are 3 different mechanisms by which solar wind is produced on the Sun and accelerated out, and we collected separate samples of those. And to do that, we had instruments built by Los Alamos that were measured the properties of the ions and electrons in the solar wind and identified the type of solar wind and then put out the appropriate array to do that. And that worked flawlessly during the course of the mission.
You mentioned there are 3 different types of solar wind. That seems interesting to me because I always thought solar wind, it's just wind. It's a solar wind coming off the Sun.
Yeah, it was. In fact, we had to learn that. A very important influence in doing this was Marcia Neugebauer, who's one of the pioneers in solar wind studies from JPL. First thing we started talking to her about doing this, the first thing she said, it's not as easy as you think. To do it right, you have to get separate samples of these 3 different kinds of solar wind. She said, oh, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. It makes it so much harder. You got to do it. So we did it. And it turned out to be very valuable.
Presumably it's important, though. I mean, if there are 3 different types of solar wind, there must be...
It's important because it was sort of known from the spacecraft data that there were compositional differences among, say, the ratio of iron to helium in these different kinds of solar wind. And so if there are compositional differences, that was part of the picture that we had to understand. And it had the great advantage for us, even thinking from the planetary science goals of Genesis, which is what we want, are the data on the solar composition, is that these different solar wind mechanisms started with the same reservoir of material. And then in the process of getting the solar wind, they change it a little bit, but they change it by different amounts. And we measure the change sample, and then we have to get help from our solar physics friends to make the corrections back. But we know that condition is we have to get back to the same answer. So we have a built-in quality control that we are making these corrections properly. We'll make three different corrections to get back to the same answer. And if we don't get the same answer, we're not making the corrections right. So this, from the quality point of view of the accuracy of the data, is very important.
So you have a self-consistent experiment. You're able to check yourself to make sure that you're not...
We have a way of proving that the answer we get is the right answer.
How long did Genesis collect particles of the solar wind for?
27 months, which was pretty much the full designed goal. We had a requirement that we had to do it for at least 2 years, and then they worked out the details of the trajectory and everything. It turned out that we got a few extra months, which we happily accepted.
Right, well, jump forward a few years, and Genesis has returned. You have samples now here on Earth in laboratories around the planet with the fantastic experimental equipment. What are you learning?
Well, once we know solar composition, we can then start looking at the evolution of different materials. And the easiest thing to start with are various kinds of meteorites, because they are basically one step removed from the solar nebula. Whereas, you know, in principle, I can take any rock from any place on Earth and work back through the whole history of the solar system from that rock. That's in principle. In practice, it turns out to be fairly hard to do. And so the simplest thing to do is start with meteoritic materials and then look at the chemical differences. How did this happen? And so once we get a better idea of how these compositional changes were between the solar nebula and meteoritic materials, then these meteoritic materials were in turn the inputs to the various planetary materials. Then we can sort of try to work our way along to bigger planets.
So you're starting with the meteors as the basic building blocks of planets. So if you understand those and their composition, then maybe we could have a track of the planets.
That's a fairly general answer. There are more specific things involved, the more specific comparisons that can be made. And let's go back again. We talked a little bit about the isotopic composition, nitrogen enrichment, nitrogen 15 to 14. There, our expectations were that the ratio, this isotopic ratio in the Earth's atmosphere, was modified from what the solar nebula gave us. And that was modified because some of the Earth's atmosphere had been lost early in its history, and the nitrogen 14 would be lost more easily than the nitrogen 15. And so we expected then to see a nitrogen 15-14 ratio that was lower because it had more nitrogen 14 in the sun than what we had in the Earth's atmosphere. The very first data, which are very preliminary, say that's not true. It looks a lot like the Earth, which is even more surprising because there are data for the atmosphere of Jupiter, which say there that there is a lot less nitrogen 15 and 14 by a whopping 40%, which in the world of isotopic variations, that's huge. And so we were expecting something down close to Jupiter. And that appears not to be true. So the sun looks more like the Earth rather than Jupiter.
That's quite surprising, isn't it? Because we expect that the sun should look more
like
Jupiter.
That's totally unanticipated, totally unanticipated. Now, that's very preliminary data. I hope we don't have it wrong, but we'll be able to verify it. Again, we have a result that's very interesting. It changes how you think about the solar system. But we're not stuck with that result for 10 years till we can mount some other kind of mission. The time scale of a year or so, we will be able to confirm that. And by an independent means, because we have the samples back. Just an enormous advantage of the quality of the science you get by having things back on Earth to study.
So you've managed to overturn a large fraction of solar system evolution theory. Would that be fair to say?
I don't know how, because we've just known this done for about a month, and so why this happened. Yes, this is a very surprising result. Yet the first order says that the outer solar system, the planets in the outer solar system, are very different than the inner solar system. And so it offers great opportunities maybe now to compare things that are seen in the Stardust mission, which brought back particles from a comet, which was an object formed from the Kuiper Belt, at 40 to 50 astronomical units from the sun. The thing is, the early results there, so that stuff looks like stuff in the inner solar system. In fact, some of it did probably come from the inner solar system, transported out, but not all of it. There has to be things that represent outer solar system materials there. So we'll have an interesting time comparing what we found with what they found. But in general, our results say that there are significant differences, at least in terms of composition, from what you have in the outer planets than what you have in the terrestrial planets.
I should point out that the differences that you're finding here between, say, the Sun and Jupiter, the differences between the inner planetary system and the outer planetary system, that these differences are from a different physical set of explanations, different set of physics than simply volatility of elements.
Right. That's because that's where the isotopes come in. The things that, you know, separate hydrogen and oxygen or hydrogen and silicon won't have big effects on the isotopes. And so it's more easy to think that isotopic variations represent input materials. We know that what comes out of stars is very isotopically heterogeneous. And what you have to say is the mix of stellar materials from formed in stars before the solar system formed that end up in the outer planets is different than what we had in the inner planets. No evidence before that was the case.
It's fascinating stuff. It has to be said that the Genesis mission didn't go completely to plan. It did return to Earth, but it returned to Earth in a, I think in your words, not with many points for style.
That's correct. Yes, the reentry capsule crashed. It hit the ground at 200 miles an hour, which is twice as fast as what we expected. But anyway, and everything was crushed and smashed and broke up to varying degrees. On the other hand, the atoms are not destroyed by this crash. And we went out and picked up the pieces, as many as we could. And whereas we were expecting to have like 250 of these 10-centimeter hexagons, we now have 15,000 samples in a size range that we can use. There are a lot of things that were destroyed. We have significant losses. Nevertheless, there's a significant number of pieces that have survived. These are smaller than what we expected, and they have a certain amount of dirt on their surface. But in principle, the dirt is on the surface. The solar wind is beneath the surface. If we clean off the dirt, we can measure the solar wind. And we have done that successfully so far. But we have, you know, as we go into harder and harder things, that dirt becomes a major challenge.
The point being is that the solar wind would have embedded itself deep
It did embed itself. And we have direct observations that showed it embedded itself pretty much where we expected it to be.
And the dirt is simply a surface
contaminant.
The dirt
is sitting on the surface, that's right.
You can easily relatively easily get rid of it.
In principle. Ah. See, the things we've done to date have either been experiments which were not sensitive to the dirt. Measuring noble gases, for example, is pretty much insensitive to the dirt. Or cases where we can look clean spots between pieces of dirt. Or if we hit a piece of dirt, we can throw away one small set of analysis and we've lost very little. We want to do experiments which in analyzing large areas on the samples, and their effective cleaning of this is a major challenge. We already know that. We already know that.
Presumably, though, the results that you get from what you believe to be a clean piece of sample, if it differs wildly from, you know, something which seems to be dirty or even doesn't seem to be dirty.
And this is what we'll do. But remember, if we could measure it on a clean piece of sample, we wouldn't try to measure it on a dirty piece of sample. So that there are things that to measure them require, you know, analyzing a large area that we wanted to do. And we will know. So how will we know we got it clean? We'll know it a couple of different ways. One is, again, if we get reproducibility. One thing about dirt, it's not reproducible. It's very heterogeneous. So if we can reproduce our measurements in replicate measurements, we will have some confidence that we're not measuring dirt. Also, in these large area things, we can measure some of the same elements that we've been able to measure in small areas like magnesium and iron, and we know the answer. Yeah. And if the magnesium number is contaminated, then we won't believe everything else. And if the magnesium number is not contaminated, then we'll have some confidence in some element that we didn't know before. So we know what to do in principle, just in practice, it's taking a while.
Is there anything that the Genesis mission set out to do which you will not be able to do because of the crash?
We set out a list of 19 different measurements that we wanted to do on a return solar wind sample. Some of these are now much more difficult. Others were not affected at all. But we, at this time, are not giving up any of the 19. We have not thrown in a towel on any one of them yet. We are challenged. We're seriously challenged. We may in the end lose a couple, but right now we're not ready to give up.
Nowhere near a disaster then.
Was not a recommended thing to have happen to you. On the other hand, it is what it is, and we're moving on.